Hi, Steve Pomerantz here, host of On the Money with today's On the Money Extra, where we feature market updates and insights as well as guest interviews with noted financial experts to help you stay informed and learn the facts to make the right decisions about money. So let's get started. Well, I just read a great book. For all of us a million miles away from Silicon Valley, who view the Valley as some magical place where dreams are made, this book shows how the sausage is really made out there, and guess what? It's a sausage, so it's not always a pretty sight. The book is Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley, and I asked the author to join me today to see if we can paint you a part of the picture that I think will satisfy any of your voyeuristic tendencies. My guest, Antonio Garcia Martinez. Welcome to the show, Antonio.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've got a long story here. Let's start out. Obviously, we have limited time, but you went to work out of Harvard. You went to Goldman Sachs, stayed there a couple of years. Take me past Goldman Sachs when you headed west. What happened then?
Just to correct, because I don't want to misconstrue, I graduated from Berkeley, actually.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah, so the story starts with me reading Michael Lewis's Liar's Poker and being unduly influenced by that presumably cautionary tale. Mm-hmm. And instead, and of course, finding it to be a siren song. And so I went to Goldman. I saw the whole credit bubble sort of grow to bursting and pop. And then I went back to the Bay Area of my grad school days. Yeah. And that's how the whole tech sort of part of the story started.
Yeah, so your timing wasn't very good there in Wall Street, I guess.
No, my timing has almost always precisely wrong, actually. But I did predict or sort of foresee that tech would sort of survive the economic apocalypse to some degree and still do well. Amazing. And so that was a good move, at least.
Well, I guess they thought you were crazy leaving Wall Street to go out and to try your hand at some risky startup.
Right. I mean, like any world, right? You know, Wall Street is very sort of self-absorbed. And, you know, a lot of people on the desk had never been west of the Mississippi, right? And so the thought that, you know, or west of Baltimore even. Yeah. So the thought that you'd, you know, fly off to some startup in California just seemed like the most ludicrous thing in the world.
So you went to work for a company and turned out you weren't crazy about the company. As a matter of fact, you kind of identified early on before everyone else that the company was really headed for its demise. And I think you characterized the people who work there as being kind of hypnotized into the dream of not really seeing the reality there, but you did see the reality. I'm talking about Adchemy. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I mean, before I seemed too prescient, I mean, I kind of fell for it as well the first half year. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, mostly because I didn't really know how to recognize the signs of sort of impending doom in a startup. And so it's the CEO was, I mean, I describe him as a sociopath, and I think it's probably safe to say that. And he was very good at sales. He was very good at projecting an image. But when it comes to the actual business of developing a product and then successfully, you know, positioning it in the market, selling it, and, you know, making money off of it, that's a whole different ball of wax. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the company basically never actually shipped a product that anyone wanted to buy, despite getting through $130 million of investment and lasting for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. But yeah, I mean, I think after a year, it was obvious to all but the most deluded that the company was going nowhere. On the upside, of course, their recruitment was actually pretty decent. And so that's where I met my two founders that led to the next chapter, which is, you know, the company that we started.
Yeah, the company's name was AdGrok, if I'm saying that right.
Yeah.
And the idea was to try to bring the small business person into the Google world because that niche had not been filled. Google was really more interested in working with these very large companies, not so much with small businesses.
Right. I mean, in case your listeners aren't familiar with you know, how Google works, when you do a search query, you know, the little things in yellow are actually ads. And for all that Google does when it comes to maps, email, self-driving cars, whatever, 97% or whatever of its revenue just comes from those little text ads next to your search results. Uh-huh. And that's the $50 billion a year business. And that's just what Google sees, right? There's layers of companies both on top of Google. And as you cite, they never really focus on the small business market. So, you know, the person with a small e-commerce site or the local plumber or whatever that wants to get found via Google ad didn't really have the tools. Yeah. And AdGrok, along with other companies, was trying to solve that. And, you know, as one of the lessons of the book, you know, that every business problem doesn't necessarily actually have a technical solution, as we discovered. because, you know, almost all the companies failed, as AdGrok effectively was failing.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that in a second. But what was particularly interesting about this is that with this new company, somehow you are able to attract some of the top venture capitalists and incubators out in Silicon Valley. I think that's probably one of the most interesting parts of the story, because it's almost like, you know, by attracting these individuals, it was like actually having a degree from Harvard, what it would represent in the East Coast.
Yeah. So the accelerator that I'd gotten into is called Y Combinator, which is sort of a wonky math term, but it's basically a company that produces other companies. And it's a big deal in Silicon Valley. It produced companies like Dropbox, Airbnb, you know, other companies you might have heard of. Mm-hmm. And it's famous for having its boot camp, which is basically a 3-month process in which they bring you in, often with not much of a product at all. And you pitch at what's called Demo Day, in which, you know, the cream of Silicon Valley venture capitalists show up and you pitch them and then you raise money. And so the story begins. But yeah, I mean, even in a company in which, you know, we had no personal entrepreneurial track record, we had no revenue at that point. In fact, we're actually getting sued. Yeah. Right, this other company we talked about, and nonetheless, and despite, you know, my general incompetence at raising money and doing the CEO thing, you know, we still raised $500,000 in almost no time, which, you know, it doesn't sound like that much, I guess. It certainly isn't a lot these days. But, you know, in 2010, the valuation and the amount was, you know, about standard for the first fundraising round for a company. And so, yeah, that's how we made it happen.
There wasn't as much funny money back then as there is now, because that was coming right out of the crash. And people were, I think, more risk averse in 2010. So now $500,000 doesn't sound like a lot, but I think perhaps back then it was. You know, you mentioned pitching, learning how to pitch to these companies. And it reminds me of what we see on TV, you know, the reality show Shark Tank. You know, that's kind of the common person's vision for startups to get money. How close do you think that process that we see so well edited and so on Shark Tank is to the real world?
You know, it's funny because one of my investors, you know, as I'm sure you noticed, Chris Sacca is now on Shark Tank. And so it's funny because I've pitched him in his pre-Shark Tank days. You know, I've only seen scenes from Shark Tank. You know, Shark Tank strikes me as very glitzy. It's almost like America's Got Talent or like the Eurovision contest, but there's like the prize is investment. So I think it's not quite accurate in that things aren't really that glitzy and glamorous in Silicon Valley. And I think even in the worst VC pitches, there's kind of a focus on product or the market or whatever technical thing you're trying to perform. I mean, there is real content there. I mean, there's a performative aspect to it, but in a half hour or 45 minute pitch, I mean, you will get to some details. And some VCs do, you know, are technically inclined and do ask, you know, real pointed questions. Mm-hmm. So I think it's something like that, but maybe not quite as Hollywood.
Yeah, well, we've interviewed a number of the judges from Shark Tank, and they tell us the behind the scenes story. I mean, it's not as if that's the first time a pitch has been made, even though it's made to seem like that. My guest is Antonio Garcia Martinez, and the book is Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. Antonio, what is Chaos Monkeys?
Yeah, everyone asks that question. It's a good one. So, I mean, picture a wild monkey rampaging through a data center, the sort of air-conditioned rooms with stacks of servers that run, you know, the information economy. There's actually a piece of software called the Chaos Monkey that was built by Netflix. And what it does is it literally goes and shuts down random servers in a data center. And then they test if they can still stream you House of Cards or whatever.
I see.
And so it actually is a piece of diagnostic software. I didn't invent the term. You know, the way I use it, though, is sort of a metaphorical usage in that, I mean, these days, Silicon Valley is sort of the zoo where society's chaos monkeys are kept. And what I mean by that is, you know, they'll look at, say, taxis and taxi medallions and say, you know what? We're not going to have taxis anymore. We're going to have this app called Uber, and anyone can become a taxi driver. And like, that's it. Suddenly a taxi medallion has zero value. Mm-hmm. Or they say, you know, hotels. Well, why do we need hotels? With Airbnb, anyone with a spare bedroom or a weekend cabin can suddenly become an innkeeper or hotel keeper, right? And we're just going to change the way real estate works. And so they basically rampage through society and knocking over or, you know, shutting down one or another industry, you know, by disruptive technology. And so that's what I mean by the chaos monkeys.
Okay, well, I see the metaphor there. And just like these monkeys going through and destroying everything, we don't really know what the outcome is going to be of all these disruptive technologies. And I think part of the issue in our economies today and the feeling of insecurity by many has been caused by this drive towards disruption that you're talking about.
I think that's absolutely right. now as an alum, I go to the demo days that I mentioned at Y Combinator in which the companies pitch. And I mean, almost every company is putting some white collar or blue collar role out of a job, like literally almost every single one. Mm-hmm. That's the reality of it. And I think one of the criticisms that one can level at Silicon Valley and that I hope to make apparent in the book is that I think people in Silicon Valley, or most people in Silicon Valley, I shouldn't say all, aren't really thinking about the repercussions. I'll set you an example. This book was partially written in Barcelona. I'm a Spanish citizen, and I just moved there to get away from Silicon Valley. And Barcelona is Airbnb's largest market in Europe. And it has completely roiled the real estate market. There are entire buildings, beautiful old buildings, that are probably kind of falling apart because the owners don't care about maintenance anymore, just because they've just rented them out to tourists and they're full of, you know, partying Swedes or Americans or whatever. And entire parts of the city are now nothing but Airbnb hotels, effectively. And, you know, that's just one impact that, you know, I know people who work at Airbnb that they've just not thought through and at some level, frankly, don't care about. But, you know, that's one of the repercussions, potentially negative, for being the chaos monkey.
You know, I recommend this book. I mean, you can see the way Antonio speaks and, you know, his use of language. The book is very smartly written and it's really quite funny. I want to read some italicized descriptions of some things. What makes a successful venture capitalist? And I'm quoting here. In the day-to-day, the lifeblood of a VC wasn't money. It was deal flow. Getting a first look at a potential Uber and Airbnb is what distinguished a first-class VC from an also-ran. Now, here's a statement on getting picked by this Y Combinator and these very high-value individuals that you work with when you started developing AdGrok. You said, these outfits are, quote, bomb-throwing anarchists, subversives mixed with cold-blooded execution, mixed with whimsy, a sort of technology-enabled 12-year-old boy. So I think that's what we're talking about is this. They're out there. Greed is the main driver, and greed is basically good in my view. I mean, it changes things. It creates capitalism. It creates new products and new services where there were none and improves our lives. But it also has many destructive characteristics. Let's get back to you. You sold AdGrok to Twitter, and then you, I don't know if you went totally to Twitter, but you did end up at Facebook. Tell us about your Facebook experience.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, that deal, just to comment on that just a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, these early stage deals, they're always touted as sort of these successes, right? This acquisition.
Yeah.
I mean, the reality is the market for engineering talent in Silicon Valley is so tight that the parts of the companies, what's called corp dev or corporate development, that buy other companies are really just glorified recruiters who basically buy, you know, engineers at volume. That's what all these acquisitions are about. I mean, the company was absolutely failing. And everyone realizes this. Everyone who's actually been down this road realizes that what are called acqui-hires, i.e. acquisition plus hiring, are really kind of failures in disguise. But so that's kind of what happened. And in my case, as often happens again, but it's just as rarely talked about, the deal got all screwy and weird because I ended up going to Facebook while the rest of the company went to Twitter.
I see. So I want to hear more about Facebook because we have limited time.
So yeah, no, I joined Facebook a year before the IPO when it was still kind of in meteoric startup mode. And, you know, I could do things like I homebrewed beer on campus and I blew up the plumbing and flooded Zuck's desk. Mm-hmm. And everyone was just like, eh, so what? And it went from that, you know, very sort of raucous, you know, every sort of stereotype of the sort of somewhat frat boy, you know, wild startup to, you know, a year after the IPO, when things got a little bit big company, a little political, you had middle managers trying to build fiefdoms and the vibe kind of changed. And I think that's why Chaos Monkeys is kind of interesting because that period is really unique to watch a company go from, you know, the sort of mid stage or early stage to the later stage, like boom, right there, just 2 years. And that, you know, that's what Chaos Monkeys is about.
Well, your 2 years at Facebook, you wrote, you resembled an Afghan warlord or pirate captain, fearsome in appearance to outsiders, the scourge of entire companies and industries, but actually barely in control of your small band of engineer hooligans and always one step from mutiny. I thought it was a terrific line.
Yeah, I mean, my role, my official title was product manager for the ads targeting system. So in terms of, you know, the beat, it was basically taking your data on Facebook and turning it into money. In terms of the role, the product manager, that's like a classic role in Silicon Valley speak. And what it means in normal speak is you're sort of the CEO of the product in a way. You're the face and the sort of navigator for the product. And the, you know, the joke is you have all the responsibility, but none of the authority, because unlike a CEO, the engineers don't actually report to you officially. They usually report through their engineering manager. Mm-hmm. And so in some sense, there was this weird duality to the outside world. You know, I was ads targeting at Facebook and every company wanted a piece of that. And, you know, here I was with this big Facebook stick. Internally, you know, I kind of had to like grovel or cajole to these various engineers and try to get them to build things, you know, and more or less kind of go in one direction.
Yeah.
And so that's the sort of weird duality that I was trying to get at there.
Well, you know, you do build up some people in the book. You skewer a number of people in the book. But what is your opinion of Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook founder?
Oh, very positive. I mean, I actually say in the book there in one of the chapters that Mark Zuckerberg is a genius. And, you know, he's not a genius. Everyone's seen The Social Network, which is unfortunate because it's kind of a fictional, it's a highly fictional movie. I mean genius in that he's like this force of nature that has managed to sort of, you know, recruit around him brilliant, very motivated people who are fired by a similar vision and who in turn go recruit other people and wrapped himself in this corporate culture in which a 23-year-old engineer feels empowered to look at Facebook and push some change and have it succeed or fail or whatever, but be in this constant maelstrom of sort of, you know, really creative dynamism and constantly shipping new products. Many of them, frankly, ill thought out or poorly executed, but whatever. The point is to actually find that winner that, you know, opens the new chapter in social media. Mm-hmm. And so creating that culture and maintaining it over years, I think is where the genius aspect comes in for Zuckerberg.
What's next for you?
You know, that's a great question. You know, I don't want to spoil, you know, the end of it, but towards the end of the book, it's a long story, but my mother died. They live in Miami, actually, in Florida.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I was raised in Miami.
Oh, of course.
The usual Miami Cuban boy. And, you know, when she died, you have these sort of experiences of mortality and you start rethinking your life. And, you know, my mental bucket list was twofold. One, to finish and publish this book that we're talking about. And then the other was to finally go sail across an ocean alone on a sailboat. I had been raised sailing in Miami since I was, you know, a little boy. Mm-hmm. And it was always this sort of deferred dream. And so I think after this book, PR dies down, I have the boat that I've been working on. So I think I'm finally going to sail to the South Pacific and back, I think.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. The book is Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. My guest, Antonio Garcia Martinez. Antonio, what a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to On the Money with certified financial planner Steve Pomerantz. If you'd like information about guests, topics, or anything you hear on this program, call 866-MONEY01 or visit the show's website at onthemoneyradio.org.